Only after this had been done did Jimmy McLean order his people to go to the next stage, and this also took time, for they rarely followed the same procedure twice. However, the one action that remained constant was that the team, working like stalking horses, would cut the target away from his or her associates and minders, making sure the contact became vulnerable, even if it was only for a minute. Often the mark would not even know what was going on, and the experienced watchers were able to do it again, then again, so that they could make use of the moves, either to lift the target off the street or give him instructions. So far, these methods had been stunningly effective, with McLean's people running rings around both police and security forces. At this time, with the year 2002 almost within spitting distance, the rise in crime across Europe and the demands of taxpayers for government accountability had reduced the number of police and military personnel who could be fielded by law and security agencies. There was also the added problem of financial limitations. Now that the old Soviet Union had completely disappeared, there was less to spend on large-scale policing or intelligence-gathering operations. An idiocy gripped many countries, and few would forget that within days of the fall of the Soviet regime, there had been serious calls from within the establishment of the United States to close down the CIA. In other countries, members of governments began to reduce the once-wide powers of their security forces, and those law enforcement agencies that had run such things as surveillance and listening services. This had started as far back as the early 90s, with the role of the British Metropolitan Police's special branch, once the mailed fist of the security service, changed almost out of recognition. Jimmy McLean, though, was not tied by restrictions of manpower. If a situation demanded 20 men and women on foot, he would put twice that number into the field. Neither was money a problem for the Alchemist organization. Difficult targets could only be removed for a great deal of money. The murders of the senior RUC officer and the SAS half-colonel had cost many millions, most of which was profit, and all of which had been raised via criminal practices on the fringes of the provisional Irish Republican Army, while the more recent killings of the Mossad agents had been funded personally by a Middle Eastern head of state. Taking Tessa by the elbow, McLean turned her away from the wind and began to stride slowly over the uneven ground. "Why, it's obvious. But who?" she asked, raising her voice. He shook his head as though trying to rid it of some memory. "Who?" she asked again. "A group calling themselves the Sons and Daughters of October." He repeated it in Russian. "I met with their man in London. He's actually a Chechen, but the organization's basically Georgian, the womb of Russia's organized crime." In his mind, a series of pictures telescoped and overlapped. The man they'd singled out had been stocky, barrel-chested, and with skin pitted like the surface of a planet. His name was Chermyet Ilyich Antonovich, and they knew he had been active on behalf of the communists. Openly, he was one of the many who said that it would be better to have Stalin in power again than the slipping, sliding, and mushy chaos of the new and recent regimes. Yet they also knew that Chermyet was on good terms with the constantly expanding Russian mafia. He'd even traveled to the United States and stayed with the mafia boss's father-in-law in Brighton Beach. When they did cut Chermyet out from his bodyguards and had a 50-second whispered conversation, "Be ready outside your room, 202 at the Cumberland Hotel, at 1 in the morning tomorrow," he had briskly nodded. He was in London talking to some highly suspect Ukrainians with links to drugs and prostitution. These people were the newly crowned princes of crime and were now undoubtedly beginning to square off with what was left of London's East End gangs and those north of the Thames. Nowadays, the criminal gangs of Europe had made use of both the economic community and the slick advances in technology. In the main, they were computer and internet literate, while a gun had long given way to the cell phone. In the current climate, millions were stolen on telephone links every week, and further millions made through the old staples of loan sharking, prostitution, drugs, and crooked gambling. Chermyet and his colleagues wanted the favor of a high-profile murder, and they were willing to pay over $3 million in sterling for the job. At 1 in the morning, he had slipped out of room 202 in the Cumberland, hard by Marble Arch, and was taken to a safe house near Paddington Station. Many of the old houses around that area had been diced and sliced into small apartments, rented monthly by whores, who advertised in telephone boxes and men's public lavatories as far away as Cambridge Circus. Jimmy owned a couple of these houses off Praed Street, once the Casbah for the pawn book trade. He never tired of telling associates of the man who had turned up at one of the places claiming to be responding to your advertisement in the Oxford Street Underground Gentleman's Convenience. Now, Jimmy described the contact, so that, in turn, Tessa could describe him to Alchemist, for their principal was a stickler for detail. It was part of both his dogma and liturgy, and there was good reason for it. A minute part of Alchemist was infected with paranoia that held that somewhere along the line a face from his past would close in, looking for unspecified revenge. A description of any contact was an automatic necessity, and to her credit, Tess always took this part of her duties seriously. He's a short, muscular man, broad shoulders, very big in the deltoids, and his thighs look thick and springy with power. Square-faced, skin like a relief map of the moon. Thick neck, light-haired, cropped to the scalp. He also has very distinctive clear blue eyes. Walks like a boxer, stands like a boxer, come to that. One foot in front of the other. Graceful on his feet. Walks as though he's about to attack. You know, a tough kind of swagger, moving at the shoulders. He fancies himself as well. Very taken with his animal magnetism, as they used to say. Not likable. Wouldn't care to meet him alone and on the wrong side, because I suspect he's fast, cocky, and can probably handle himself very decently. McLean closed his mouth tightly, as though he could smell the Russian close to him. If the boss knows him, I guess that description will open the doors. If not, we've got pictures. To be honest, Tess, we didn't like dealing with him, though he's obviously the bollocks, as they say. If we still had the provost coming to us for help, I'd have turned him down. But as things are, well, the Good Friday Agreement hasn't done us any favours. Jermiet had answered all the questions openly. It had been chilling to hear him talk of murder, maiming, blinding, or castrating with as much emotion as a cabbage. Jimmy had a permanent picture of him with his beer-swelled gut and hairy hands spread on thighs, as he sat in the whore's small parlour and talked. "You ask why we will not do this thing ourselves? You have to ask that? Then you are fools if you cannot tell why we will not do it. It is much too dangerous for us. Also, it must be done outside Mother Russia herself. We cannot afford any trace back to us. This is essential." The room smelled of an expensive deodorant, and not until later did McLean realize the scent came from Chermiet himself. When the deal was done, the man removed his shirt to reveal a million in high-denomination sterling, hidden in pockets sewn into the shirt. The deal was for a further million to be delivered within 24 hours, and the remainder on completion. "Though if they don't pay up, I don't see that there's much we can do about it," McLean said, laughing. Tessa felt uncomfortable at times when frivolity ran hand in hand with the serious, terrible business of murder. They offered Jermiet a whore and secretly videotaped him humping her with a laboriously grim determination. None of Jimmy McLean's people would ever have done this. Now, in the present, as they walked in the blowing fine drizzle in the Wicklow Gap, Jimmy told Tessa that the Russian had claimed the president had been the real power behind the attempted coup in 1991. "Why did you think there were a few suicides and the rest were never prosecuted?" Chermiet had said, with an unpleasant laugh. "These idiots were manipulated, and I don't think many people even guessed what had happened. This was the overthrow of the lawful government. To kill the president and his young, lecherous wife is very dangerous. But if your man can do it and get away, it is worth our entire future. There will be more contracts for you afterwards, and many other things we can plan together.